From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Zulu leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi has called off his boycott of next week's multiracial elections in South Africa. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with two native South Africans about the changing nature of the elections. Dumisani Khumalo was born in Zululand and grew up in Johannesburg. He was a journalist until the late 70s when he fled South Africa to come to the United States. Now he's back in South Africa to serve as a monitor for the upcoming elections. Gerhard Murray is the co-author of a book about Buthelezi called An Appetite for Power. He teaches at the University of Natal. Later, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of George Gershwin's Piano Rolls. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Inkatha Freedom Party has agreed to participate in the upcoming South African elections. The deal came out of a meeting between the leaders of the three main political forces in South Africa. NPR Suni Khaled reports from Durban.
President F.W. de Klerk announced today that an agreement has been reached that will allow the Inkatha Freedom Party to participate in the country's first all-race elections next week. De Klerk made the announcement following a second day of high-level talks in Pretoria with Inkatha leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi and African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela. Buthelezi had threatened to boycott the elections to protest South Africa's interim constitution. This led to increasing political violence and the declaration of a state of emergency in the province of Natal, where more than 230 people have died this month in clashes between Inkatha and ANC supporters. In Durban, regional peace monitors say the agreement could help reduce the level of political violence before elections. I'm Suni Khaled in Durban.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin has called on the Bosnian Serbs to end their siege of Garajda. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
In a tersely written statement issued to news organizations, Yeltsin said the Bosnian Serbs must now stop their attack on Garajda, leave the town, and permit UN peacekeeping troops to enter. It was the bluntest demand from the Russian leader so far in the Bosnian crisis, and a further signal that Russia's government is fed up with the behavior of the Bosnian Serbs. Yeltsin said that by ending the siege of Garajda, the Serbs would fulfill an obligation to Russia. Yeltsin called the conflict in Bosnia on the brink of dangerous escalation. It is time for decisive measures to end the crisis, he said. And to this end, he proposed a summit involving the United States, Russia, the European Union, and the United Nations. Over the past 3 days, there has been a distinct shift in Russia's attitude to the Bosnian Serbs. From implicit support for their aims, key Russian leaders, on up to President Yeltsin, have become disillusioned with them. Tomorrow, the Yeltsin government is expected to take the issue to the Russian parliament, which is still dominated by their supporters here. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Meanwhile, NATO officials say they're taking an urgent but cautious look at United Nations' request for airstrikes against the Serbs. The Associated Press says the UN request probably will not be rejected, but the consequences must be looked at. The request will likely be discussed tomorrow night at the alliance's regular gathering of ambassadors. The UN can already call in NATO strikes against forces attacking peacekeepers, but it needs approval from NATO nations before it can use wider raids. All seven women members of the Senate plan to vote today against giving the Navy's top admiral a 4-star retirement rank. The bipartisan group cites the Tailhook sexual abuse scandal for its reason. Admiral Frank Kelso was at the 1991 Tailhook Convention, during which dozens of women alleged they were sexually harassed and abused. Kelso says he never saw any of that abuse. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down half a point at 3,619. This is NPR. The Supreme Court says keeping people off the juries because of their sex is just as illegal as keeping them off because of their race. The justices voted 6-3, saying the Constitution's guarantee of equal protection bars gender-based jury selection. The decision is a victory for a defendant in a paternity lawsuit. He says his rights were violated when a female jury decided he fathered a boy born 4 years ago. Chrysler is reporting record first-quarter profits. The number three automaker posted net earnings of $938 million, or $2.55 per share. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
Chrysler has introduced a steady string of popular new products over the past few years, and the success of those vehicles is credited with the automaker's strong financial performance. The first quarter of the year was Chrysler's best three-month period ever in terms of profits. Sales and revenues for the quarter were also the best ever for the number three automaker. Company officials also say strong demand for cars and trucks will result in the addition of several thousand assembly line jobs over the next 3 years. Chrysler's earnings report is yet another sign of the ongoing resurgence of the domestic automobile industry. Car sales are booming to the point where many dealers can't get all the vehicles they want. General Motors and Ford will release their first quarter earnings later this month. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
A published report says Congressman Dan Rostenkowski is proposing several ideas to overhaul Social Security. The New York Times says the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee suggests reducing next year's cost of living adjustment for Social Security recipients. That would be held to 2.5%. The report says Rostenkowski is looking at raising the age for retirement with full benefits. It now stands at 65 and will rise to 67 for people born in 1960 or later. Rostenkowski suggests that this should be changed to 67 for people born in 1949 and later. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There was a breakthrough today in South Africa which might reduce the violence surrounding next week's election. Zulu leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi, head of the Inkatha Freedom Party, agreed to call off his boycott of the election. Earlier today, we phoned Dumisani Kamalo in Johannesburg. He's coordinating the Election Watch campaign for the Africa Fund, an education and advocacy group based in New York that supports political and economic justice in Africa. Kamalo was born in Zululand. He co-founded the Union of Black Journalists. After the group was banned by the South African government in 1977, he fled to the United States, where he has been living in exile. He first returned to his country after Nelson Mandela's release from prison. I asked him how the end of the boycott might change his work as an election observer.
Well, it changes my work in the sense that instead of only monitoring in the urban areas of Johannesburg, which is known as the Witwatersrand Rand, I am now going to be one of the few observers who are going to go deep into the heart of Zululand and monitor in a place called Blood River. Now, that's important to me because I was born in Blood River almost 48 years ago. And this is in the heart of Zululand, where probably even the news of the agreement today won't filter down until tomorrow or even the day after.
So you're going to be going to Blood River in Zululand because now the people there will be participating in the voting?
Yes, because people there will be participating in the voting. And it's very, very important for those people to have international observers witnessing their process, because these are the people who are the illiterate people in this country. These are the people who are in the rural area where, for the most part, there is no electricity, there is no paved roads, and you know, and the only communication is by radio.
What does it mean to you personally to go back to the place where you were born to monitor the election?
Well, you know, remember, you know, I to me, it's a very emotional time quite often, because I remember being a victim of the South African government and its apartheid policies. And those apartheid policies forced me into exile. And, you know, and there are many wounds I can look into. There are many hurtful situations I can look into. For instance, before I went into exile, the last thing that made me leave and go into exile was that the police raided my home and threw my wife against the wall, and she had a miscarriage, and there was nothing I could do about it. So this election represents an end of a very painful era for all black South Africans, and this is why it's such a significant election. This is not an election about ideology. This is not an election about which party is better on foreign policy or which party is better on jobs or the environment. This is a symbolic election that ends 350 years of white minority rule.
What is Buthelezi getting in return for calling off the boycott?
Well, what he gets in return is every political party here has received money to run the election. So he gets money to run his election, and he gets to become one of the phrase that is used here in South Africa is one of the major players in this election. And, you know, he had lost total credibility throughout the world. You know, there are many conservative people around the world who loved Buthelezi, people like former President Bush, former President Reagan, Oliver North, and all that crowd. They loved and supported Buthelezi, but even they were getting concerned that Buthelezi was holding the democratic process hostage. So, you know, he Buthelezi, in a way, gets some of his credibility back from his conservative supporters because he finally gives in and allows an election to take place.
Do you think that there will still be opposition to the election in KwaZulu now that Buthelezi has called off the boycott?
No. There may be a little bit, but no, there won't be as much opposition as there would have been, because both the Zulu King and Buthelezi have said now they are part of the process. So, you know, the only opposition will last 2-3 days because, you know, parts of Zululand are not accessible by media. And, you know, so the people there, the word might not get out to the rural, deep Zululand villages that, you know, it's okay now to vote. But by next week, those people would have received the message. One of the things is that there's a whole network of people who work in the urban areas and live in the hostels. You know, these are the ones responsible for the violence, to a large part responsible to the violence that happens in the urban area. They are all going to be going back home this weekend. I mean, thousands and thousands of Zulus are going to drive back to Zululand because, you know, by an arrangement in this country, you can only vote for your region, or like in the United States, it would be like for your state, if you are in your region, you know, like in your state. So everybody who wants Inkatha to win the region of KwaZulu-Natal, they are all going to leave the urban areas and go down there. And, you know, so word will filter down by this weekend from the thousands and thousands who will go back to prepare for the election that it's okay to vote, and, you know, and that Inkatha will be on the ballot and that they are free to vote for Inkatha then.
What kinds of problems are you expecting to encounter during the election?
The biggest problem is going to be literacy. Remember that there's a potential number, and these numbers are guesses too by the Independent Electoral Commission, but they are telling us that they expect close to 23 million voters. And 23 million voters who about 18 million to 20 million of them cannot are illiterate, cannot read properly or write properly. They will have to be assisted in the polling station. So what's going to happen is that that's going to slow down the process because it's all done by hand. If you can read, even for me who can read, you look at that ballot, it's a long piece of paper. It's got 20 names and, you know, and symbols that almost look alike and, you know, parties that almost have the same abbreviations, and, you know, so you really have to be able to be careful to find the one you want to vote for. And, you know, so that's really going to be the problem. And I think the frustration from the lines, the frustration from the inability to do this process more is the only thing that can really trigger up some more troubles. And, you know, but the violence is expected to be really minimized now that the agreement has been made.
Have you observed any of the pre-election violence? Has that happened in your presence?
Yes, there has been violence, and, you know, but most of the violence, though, happens around hostels. This is where the journalist, where photographer, the news photographer who got killed yesterday, and about 18 people died yesterday. That's the violence that happens around hostels. Now, the reason the hostels, which are these male barracks, the reason they have been a center of violence is that they are the Inkatha party strongholds. And so these men who are in the hostels are trying to prevent people in the townships from preparing for the election or holding political rallies. And when the peacekeeping force came in to try and separate the hostel dwellers from the township dwellers, that's how the violence happened. And the press that went to cover this thing was caught in the crossfire, and one of the well-known news photographers here was tragically killed yesterday, and 18 other people died with him. So, you know, most of the violence happens in specific areas, but for the vast area of South Africa, there is no, life goes on. You know, there is fear, but there is no violence.
The hostels that you're talking about is where black workers live who have moved just to get work.
Yes, we have moved from places like Zululand to come and work in the city. They come here without their families. Their families stay in rural Zululand, and they come up here to come and seek work. And this goes back to the days of the apartheid government, when black people were not allowed to bring their wives or their families here. To give you a personal example, in my family, my father was a migrant worker. And this means, in practical terms, that my sister was born in 39, my brother in 38, another one in 40, another one in 41, another one in 42, because my father came home once a year. And, you know, so these migrant workers come into the city, they leave their families there, and, you know, and they travel once a year or once every 6 months.
Is that going to end when the apartheid government officially ends?
No, it's for a large part, it's not going to end, because there is no housing in Johannesburg. For instance, to use Johannesburg as an example, in Johannesburg there are millions of homeless families who live in shacks, these are structures made out of cardboard or plastic, and you know they live in what are known as squatter camps. There are 8 million South African people who live in squatter camps. One in five of black South Africans live in squatter camps. They have no houses, and the reason they have no houses is that the legacy of apartheid includes the Land Act, which said 87% of South African land is for whites only, and 13% can only be occupied by black people. The problem, though, is that there are only 4 million whites who have access to 87% of the land, and there's 35 million African people who have access to 13% of the land. So it is the government then forced split families by forcing the men to leave their wives and children in the rural areas of Zululand and other places, come and work in the city, and then go back home. So, you know, even if these men in the hostels decided on April 30th after the election that they don't want to live in hostels, they want to bring their wives here, there is nowhere to bring their families. And that's not going to change in the next 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and, you know, until the government deals with the issue of land.
My guest is Dumisani Khumalo. He's coordinating the South Africa Election Watch campaign for the Africa Fund. We'll be right back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with South African election monitor Dumisani Khumalo. You are of Zulu heritage. I'm wondering if
yes,
I'm wondering if there was ever any fighting within your family politically about whether to support Buthelezi or not.
Oh, there is. There is. My relatives in Zululand, for instance, they are very, very strong Buthelezi supporters because they are nationalistic. They say he's one of ours. The other reason why, which you don't read about in the media, the reason Buthelezi seems to attract so many Zulus is that in 1936 and to 38, the government amended the Land Act and, you know, took away land and took away livestock, you know, like cattle, like sheep, from black people as a way of denying them other means of living so that black people could come to live in the mines. And the only person who saved my father's cattle, for instance, who saved the cattle my father had paid as a bride price for my mother, was Buthelezi's father. And, you know, so the Zulus remember Buthelezi's father for having played a very important role in trying to save them, their livestock, in trying to save the little bit of the land they had from the white government. And that's why some of them follow him like this. It's not because of Buthelezi himself, but it's because his father represented something good. I always remember in Alabama, an African-American old man, and I asked him why he voted for the Republican Party. And he said, "You don't understand, child. Lincoln was the one who helped us get free, and I vote for the Republican Party not because of Barry Goldwater and, you know, or Ed Meese or any of these people. I vote for it because this is the party that brought us freedom." It's exactly the same thinking in Zululand, that they look at Buthelezi and say it's because of what his father did that we are supporting him.
What was his father's name?
Oh, his father was called Mathole. So whenever they refer to him, they say Umntwana ka Mathole. You know, this is Mathole's child. You know, so they never say Chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi.
And how come you do not support Buthelezi?
Well, I do not support Buthelezi because Buthelezi has been responsible for many, many people losing their lives. And Buthelezi is not democratic. I mean, I am a Democrat in deep at heart. I mean, I'm in small D Democrat. And I've seen Nelson Mandela. I've known him for years, and I've traveled with him on the campaign trail, and I know him. But I also happen to know Chief Buthelezi very, very well. And, you know, and I know his family, I know his mother. The place where I come from is in the same district like him. And I like Buthelezi just as a person, but he's a horrible politician, unfortunately. And, you know, and I couldn't vote for him. And so, you know, Mandela represents the best of South Africa to me.
What are some of your fears and hopes for South Africa after the election?
Well, my fears are that a lot of people who live in the most godforsaken conditions, people who live in human settlements and shacks and what have you, will become so impatient now that there's a new government that they will think that their life conditions will change overnight. I know, living in the United States, that the conditions of people do not change very easily. And I live in Brooklyn, New York, and I live in Flatbush. And I look at Flatbush after 200 years of American independence, and here it is, we're talking about South Africa, which will only be independent next week. And, you know, so I know that these conditions will take a long time. But my sister, who lives in one of these shacks, my younger sister, keeps on saying to me, "I'm going to vote because I know that if I vote for Mandela, I'm going to get a house and get out of this shack that I live in." And I keep on telling her that it's not going to be that easy. And, you know, but not many people understand that it's not going to be that easy. Mandela tells them on the campaign trail that it's going to take time before things change. But, you know, the pain of living under apartheid and the legacy of the apartheid system is so painful and so devastating that my fear is that people might not have the patience. My hope, however, is that, you know, this country is endowed with minerals, is endowed with a beautiful infrastructure. This country is endowed with natural resources that are enough for everybody. And I keep on hoping that all South Africans, irrespective of race, including the Afrikaners themselves, will realize that this is their country, they can do the best of it, and put their hearts and their minds to it and rebuild this country.
One last question. You've been living in exile in the United States. Do you plan to move back to South Africa?
Well, I love the United States, and, you know, and I've come to love living in Brooklyn, and, you know, I'm a United States citizen. I have a son in college over there. And, you know, so I love the United States. I love South Africa, too. And I get torn sometimes, you know, because, you know, I sit here and say, my God, this is home. This is where I should be. And then, of course, I sit back and say, oh, my Lord, what's happening in Brooklyn at my place? I should be home in Brooklyn. So I'm still at a split decision. But, you know, the only thing, though, is that, you know, you don't know this, but my parents died when I was in exile. And I begged this South African government of Mr. de Klerk to allow me just to attend their funerals. They refused me that right. And so I'm relieved today that I have the right to, if I have the money, to climb on a plane, come to New York, come to Johannesburg, and, you know, and visit my family if I so desire. And I can, if I have the money, take off and go to the United States. So I have best of both worlds.
Dumisale Khumalo was coordinating the Election Watch campaign for the Africa Fund. He spoke to us from Johannesburg. Not everyone shares his optimism that the end of the election boycott will greatly reduce the violence surrounding the election. Jenny Irish is a human rights activist who's now the coordinator of the Network of Independent Monitors, a politically neutral organization which is monitoring election-related violence in South Africa. She's working in Natal Province, which has been under a state of emergency this month because of election-related violence. Are you confident that the end of the boycott will also end the violence around the election?
No, not really. I mean, I think if you look at the levels of political intolerance that exist in the country and particularly in the Natal region, I think that the end of the boycott of the election could go some way in ending it, but I certainly don't think that it's going to kind of wave some magic solution to that violence. I think that violence is very likely to continue over the next week and then after the elections.
Well, what are the other sources of the violence?
Well, I mean, you have a whole lot of different sources. One aspect would obviously be criminal violence, which in a situation like Natal very often becomes politicized. Other sources of the violence would be just not allowing free political activity in that area, and just complete lack of intolerance, you know, just complete intolerance of anybody with a different political view to yourself. Now, obviously, participating in elections doesn't do away with that kind of violence necessarily, you know, on any side.
Jenny Irish is the coordinator of the Network of Independent Monitors. She spoke with us from Natal. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. More on the South African elections in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Zulu leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi has called off his boycott of next week's election. It's the first racially inclusive election in South Africa. Coming up, we talk with Gerhard Marais, the co-author of a book about Buthelezi. He teaches at the University of Natal. George Gershwin made about 130 piano rolls of his compositions. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new CD that brings 12 of them together. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United Nations says the Bosnian Serbs have seized 18 anti-aircraft guns from peacekeepers in Sarajevo. The UN says between 100 and 150 Serbian militiamen stormed into the barracks and took some of the heavy weapons under guard there. The 50 French peacekeepers did not fire on them, fearing a bloodbath. Meanwhile, the UN says one of its main relief buildings in Garajda has been shelled by the Serbs. Peter Kessler is a spokesman for the UN Relief Agency.
Our office received two direct hits, one after the other, rocking the building and shattering the remaining glass that remains. Right now, it seems that our building is being directly targeted. At least it's received periodic hits in the last 24 hours. It leads us to believe that the Bosnian Serbs know exactly where we are. In addition, of course, there is a lot of heavy machine gun fire and anti-aircraft fire raining down on the town. Our staff told us that there is more anti-aircraft fire incoming on the civilian population than at any time in the past days.
The Serbs have offered a couple of ceasefires but have failed to observe any of them. Russian Special Envoy Vitaly Churkin says he's never seen so many broken promises, and he's advised Moscow to break off talks with the Serbs. Russia has historically supported the Serbs. Russian President Boris Yeltsin is calling for a summit on the Bosnian crisis, but President Clinton says this would be premature. The space shuttle Endeavour will spend another day in orbit. Today's scheduled landing was canceled because of bad weather in Florida. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
High winds blowing across the shuttle's landing strip forced the space agency to scrub Endeavour's return. There were two opportunities to bring Endeavour back to Florida, but both were ruled out because of cloud cover or high winds. Rather than send the shuttle and its six crew members to California, NASA has decided to leave the shuttle in space for an 11th day. The Space Radar Laboratory, flying aboard the shuttle, is scheduled to fly again in August. There is no contingency time built into getting the payload ready for its next flight, so a diversion to California would mean that the next radar mission would probably be delayed. There are two more opportunities to bring Endeavour back to the Kennedy Space Center tomorrow. The first chance is scheduled for 11:30 Eastern Time. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
Defense Secretary William Perry is in Seoul, South Korea. He's reviewing U.S. and allied military preparations on the Korean Peninsula, including setting up Patriot anti-missile batteries. There are plans for a major military exercise, too. North Korea sees joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises as a dress rehearsal for a nuclear attack. North Korea has demanded for years that they be stopped. Stock prices fell today on Wall Street. The Dow lost over half a point to close at 3,619. Declining issues led advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. The Commerce Department says the nation's trade deficit is the worst it's been in 6 years. The agency says the deficit is nearly $9.75 billion. That's up 46% from the January report. The largest deficit was with Japan. Analysts say the report shows the trouble that the U.S. exporting industry is having selling its goods abroad. Surviving Branch Davidians are gathering today for a memorial service at the site of Mount Carmel outside Waco, Texas. 1 year ago today, a giant fire led to the deaths of 79 followers of David Koresh. NPR's Wade Goodwin reports.
All that is left of what the world came to know as the Branch Davidian compound is a few mounds of dirt and rubble surrounded by a chain-link fence. It's now a thriving tourist attraction. The surviving students of David Koresh have come from all over the country to commemorate this first anniversary of the fire which ended the two-month FBI siege and to remember those who died. Sheila Martin lost her husband and three children last April 19th.
There's something that still stays with you, that still makes you remember that it hurt so very much then and it still hurts now. This never should have happened. They should not have had to die that way. And they wanted to live.
Eight Davidians remain in federal prison in San Antonio on felony weapons convictions. For National Public Radio, I'm Wade Goodwin in Austin.
Chrysler Corporation says it's earned a higher-than-expected profit of $938 million for the first quarter of this year. The earnings contrast sharply with the report of last year of nearly $4.5 billion in losses for Chrysler. The number three automaker says its latest report is worth about $2.55 per share. A spokeswoman for former President Richard Nixon says he's paralyzed on most of his right side following a stroke. He's also not able to speak. An official prognosis from his physicians is due later today. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Zulu leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi, the head of the Inkatha Freedom Party, has agreed to participate in next week's South African election. He's called off his election boycott. My guest Gerhard Murray is the co-author of a book about Buthelezi called An Appetite for Power. Murray is a senior lecturer in the Department of Sociology and the Center for Industrial and Labor Studies at the University of Natal. Natal has been under a state of emergency since the beginning of the month as a result of election-related violence. I asked Murray for his interpretation of why Buthelezi called off the boycott.
Buthelezi called off the boycott because he managed to gain some of the concessions that he'd been wanting. What he basically wants to do is to tie the elected representatives of people in South Africa to as many aspects of a new constitution that he would like. In other words, he's trying to say that let's have the elections, but you will not have a free hand after the elections have taken place, even if you win a majority of the seats in Parliament. You will not have a free hand to draw up the constitution as you would like to do that. In other words, that we, as Inkatha Freedom Party supporters and as supporters of the Zulu King, wish to limit the amount of freedom that you will have in drawing up the new constitution. What we then have to say is, in what way did they limit the freedom of the constituent assembly, which will draw up the new constitution? And he's done it in two important ways. The first one is to get an acknowledgement that the region of KwaZulu-Natal, where Buthelezi's power base lies, will have a Zulu king as a monarch, and that Zulu king will have certain powers granted to him. Those are still undefined, but it was agreed that those would be negotiated after the elections. The second one is that any other outstanding issue would be taken to international mediation after the elections, extending the process of Buthelezi's influence, even if he loses the election hopelessly. That has now been written into the agreement that will bind a constituent assembly for the next period of time in South Africa.
When Buthelezi was boycotting the election, what was he afraid of losing through the election?
Buthelezi was afraid of losing power. The power that he's had for the last 22 years or so has been through the existence of the KwaZulu-Bantustan, the KwaZulu homeland, that apartheid creation. And that gave him power largely because he was able to rely on what is known as traditional authority, the chiefs within KwaZulu, who still dominate the KwaZulu government. He would have lost that if he had participated in the elections before the present concessions. What he's now trying to do is that even if he loses the elections in the region, he will still have a power base through the acknowledgement of the power of the Zulu king. And in that sense, it has been a struggle for power, the maintenance of power.
How much of Buthelezi's power came from the apartheid system?
Well, up to now, a lot of it did. In fact, probably most of it did, because what participation in the apartheid structure meant is that also meant that a whole lot of the potential patronage deals that he could make existed through the KwaZulu government. He controlled pensions, he controlled land, he controlled jobs, he controlled a whole range of areas that he could dispense with in exchange for support. And there are documented instances where that occurred. Now, in that way, he most certainly benefited from it. The other way in which he benefited from it is that it gave him a platform from which to speak when other movements who, for whatever reason, whether correct or incorrect, doesn't matter, where other movements that decided not to participate in that, in fact, the African National Congress was operating as a banned organization, therefore could not operate above ground in South Africa, was operating from exile. Their publications were not distributed in South Africa, whereas Buthelezi could continue with that. He was, had access to radio, he had access to television, he had access to the media, and most certainly used that very effectively.
So how much of his power base does he get to keep now with the concessions he was given after calling off the boycott?
Well, that's not clear. That's not clear at all. The details of that still have to be worked out. What was basically, as far as I can see, what was agreed to was, first of all, a recognition that this region will be a monarchy. It will be it will have a king. The King Goodwill Zwelithini will be the king of this region. But the details of how the kingship will be incorporated into the new constitution, that they've left to the period after the elections. So it's not quite clear what will come out of that. And I think that that, to some extent, will depend on the number of votes that Buthelezi gains in these coming elections.
Now, how does the concession of allowing King Zwelithini to remain the Zulu king after the election, how much does that affect the future of South Africa?
Not directly. Indirectly it does, because it means that this particular region in South Africa will have a constitution that's quite considerably different from the rest of South Africa. And the details of that and the amount of power given to the king and what kind of structures will surround the king, that still needs to be worked out. So the exact extent of that influence is not quite clear. But it will most certainly have a very great effect on regional politics.
My guest is Gerhard Murray, co-author of a book about Buthelezi called An Appetite for Power. He teaches at the University of Natal. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Gerhard Murray, who is speaking with us from Natal. You've written that the Inkatha Party has exploited the racial differences created by apartheid. How?
They've done that as well, exploited the racial differences created by apartheid, but even more importantly, they've exploited the ethnic aspect of the apartheid policy. What the apartheid policy did from 1959 on, it was based on the notion that there are different peoples amongst the African people in South Africa, and that those peoples or nations would each need their own territory within which they would then gain self-determination. Now, African people had no say over that policy. It was foisted on them. What Buthelezi did is he participated within those structures. In other words, that his power base on one level, and by far the most important level, was based within ethnic structures, divisive structures. His justification for that was, first of all, that he would change the system from within, but the second justification was from the very start that there is such a separate political entity as the Zulu nation, and that therefore he was justified in participating in the apartheid structures, even though he did not like the allocation of land, the allocation of money, the allocation of power that went along with that policy. So in that sense, he did use it. He did use it, and he benefited from it.
For about 10 years, there's been fighting between Inkatha and the ANC. How did that start? What was it about when it started?
It's a history that lies tied into the notion that Buthelezi had of what Inkatha was and what his role was within South Africa during the 1970s. During the 1970s, he could, with some justification, claim that in a way he was a continuation of the African National Congress within South Africa. When Inkatha was formed, it appealed to many of the same leaders. It appealed, for example, to Chief Luthuli, a Nobel Prize winner and the last president of the African National Congress before it was banned in South Africa in 1960. It appealed to him and said he was a Zulu, he was the kind of person who gave legitimacy to Buthelezi's own particular political project. It furthermore, it had the support of the African National Congress leadership during the 1970s for what it was doing within South Africa, and that's another history that needs to be written. But what happened at the end of the 1970s is that the Inkatha broke with the African National Congress for a whole set of reasons once again, but it lost that legitimacy of being a national movement. And that altered the direction that it was going to follow after that period of time. In the 1980s, for example, it forced it to become much more of a regional political movement. And the legacy of that is to be seen today.
How much of the dispute between the ANC and Inkatha is truly an ethnic dispute?
No, it's not directly an ethnic dispute. It's about who will represent people at the political level. And what Inkatha has done, it has used the ethnic card to claim that it represents a much wider constituency than it can genuinely do. It is claiming to represent the Zulu people, as though it is some kind of a homogeneous mass. Now, obviously, that's not the case. While Zulu-speaking Inkatha members have a lot in common with Zulu-speaking ANC members on a cultural and social identity level, at the political level, they don't. And in that sense, Inkatha has used ethnicity, but it's not primarily an issue about ethnicity. Inkatha has used it to try and define its own constituency, and in that sense, it's ethnic. What they've done, for example, to make my points clearer, is what they did when it became clear that Inkatha could not claim to represent all Zulu-speaking people in South Africa. They created the category, they being Buthelezi and the King especially, created the category of traitor. In other words, those people who would, by any other standard, and including their self-definition, would call themselves Zulu, were now traitors to the cause because they did not follow the political line that was demanded of them by the King and by Buthelezi.
Are you worried at all about your safety as a white middle-class person if there is a black government in South Africa?
No, I'm not. I think that there might be problems that we're all concerned about, the way in which a government might act. But those would be questions around civil liberties rather than as being a white person in South Africa. No, I'm not scared of that at all.
What are the civil liberties concerns that you have?
Well, we still have to see how a new government, first of all, which that new government will be, and I think it's without any doubt that it will be the African National Congress, but also in the way in which internal struggles within the African National Congress will be played out. So it's not possible for me to say that will be the way in which it goes, but my particular concerns now, talking as somebody who teaches at the university, to what extent will we be able to start freely examining the past, freely digging up the past, freely engaging in debate. I think that would be incredibly important to the extent to which we can provide alternatives that would be allowed within a general process of reconstruction. And I'm not denying that there will be a tremendous responsibility on everybody to work towards as much of a shared goal as possible, but that shared goal should not simply deny the possibility of diversity, the possibility of dissent.
Have there been restrictions on what you teach or how you teach?
There most certainly was under apartheid. There clearly was. There were masses of material that we could not use. There was a lot of statements, what people were saying, African National Congress, South African Communist Party, any banned person in South Africa could not be quoted. And that limited the scope of what you could do tremendously. You had to frequently find oblique ways of saying what you wanted to say because you could not say that straightforwardly. And I think that has most certainly limited. Well, it did. I mean, it bound us and chained us for many, many years under apartheid. Now, that clearly has relaxed considerably, and there are many more issues that we can now, in fact, we have much greater freedom at the moment in what we teach. But I think that they are still, because of the nature of politics at the moment, both the legacy of apartheid, the legacy of 10 years in this region of violence, that there are certain issues that I most certainly am personally aware of that I would treat very, very delicately because I would not know how people would respond to that. So using a course on democracy in South Africa is actually in many ways walking a tightrope. making, arguing for the legitimacy of talking about fairly contentious issues in an academic environment, and that those, no matter what people's personal views are, no matter what their political support is, that one should be allowed to raise debate around that. And that has been not difficult, but it has been, I've had to walk a very careful path, and I'm sure that some of my colleagues have had the same problem.
What are the issues that you still find difficult to talk about in class?
Well, let's just take that at the moment, for 10 years, what we have had here is that two political movements, and not only that, the state is centrally involved in the violence, but two political movements have been in violent conflict. And the state most certainly has used that and has initiated and instigated a lot of that violence. But to then talk in class about the conflict between the African National Congress and Inkatha and maintain that at the level of within a general discussion about democracy has at times been, I've had to be careful about that because they are both Inkatha Freedom Party and ANC supporters within the students that I teach. So it is difficult to find a way in which to present issues in a more generalizable way rather than to link it to a specific political position.
Gerhard Murray is the co-author of An Appetite for Power, Buthelezi's Inkatha and South Africa. He teaches at the University of Natal. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what will you have on the end of the Inkatha boycott of the South Africa election?
Terry, our South Africa correspondent, and Cooper will be telling us what has happened, and we will be talking to a professor of political science from Natal Province on the background of the split between Inkatha and the ANC and what is likely to come out of this new agreement. Also, we'll be talking to Ambassador Rawson, the U.S. ambassador to Rwanda, who is back from that country and can tell us what he saw and what he thinks will happen there. Also, Michel Trudeau has a piece on preventing child abuse from Santa Fe, and Noah has a book, Miss Spider's Tea Party.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. George Gershwin never made a phonograph recording of his first big hit, Swanee, but you can now hear Gershwin himself performing it. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has an explanation of this seeming contradiction.
At the beginning of this century, before the phonograph acquired absolute supremacy, there was another way you could listen whenever you felt like it to famous people playing music in your home, on the player piano. You put a roll of punched-out paper into the pianola, you pumped the pedals, later all you had to do was turn on the switch, the keys started to move, and there was an invisible Horowitz or Gustav Mahler, who never made a phonograph record, playing your piano. The most popular piano rolls were of pop tunes. George Gershwin made about 130, and Elektra Nonsuch has just released about a dozen of them on a new CD. The original reproducing equipment for piano rolls was remarkably good. You didn't have to put up with the scratchy surface noise or the short lifespan of 78s. And you could hear all sorts of subtleties, changes in tempo, and even more remarkably, in dynamics. Of course, piano rolls could never capture the nuances of rhythm that make a live performance breathe. Even at their most sophisticated, piano rolls always sound mechanical. Finally, they just couldn't compete with the technical advances of the phonograph. But what's special about these Gershwin rolls is that they are so self-aware, practically postmodern in the consciousness of their own possibilities. Gershwin and his editors, especially a brilliant technician named Frank Milne, would actually overdub the original roll cut by Gershwin himself, adding extra notes that a single performer couldn't possibly play. So even though these rolls can't equal the spontaneity of Gershwin's own phonograph recordings, some of them come amazingly close, and they add a sly complexity that has its own integrity. They can still give you, here's the song cue, that certain feeling. This album includes some of Gershwin's rarest material, from his first published song, When You Want 'Em, You Can't Get 'Em, When You've Got 'Em, You Don't Want 'Em, to an unpublished salon piece called Novelette in Fourths. There's Gershwin's abbreviated version of Rhapsody in Blue, and Frank Milne playing his own astonishing transcription of The Complete American in Paris. The realizations by Artis Woodhouse, with the help of computers, are the best piano roll reproductions I've ever heard. We can hear what George Gershwin himself would have almost sounded like on a brand new piano, in real stereo, and in our own living rooms.
Lloyd Schwartz reviewed Gershwin Plays Gershwin, The Piano Rolls, on the Elektra Nonesuch label. Lloyd is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Last week, he won the Pulitzer Prize for criticism. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with help today from Philo Holland, research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, economic trade wars and political upheaval. We'll talk about Japan and its relations with America. My guest will be James Fallows, Washington editor of the Atlantic Monthly and author of the new book about Japan, Looking at the Sun. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.